This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 73rd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me today Robert Vamosi. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Gary.
Robert Vamosi is a senior analyst with Mokana and a well-known reporter in the security space. His recent book, When Gadgets Betray Us, is about everyday gadgets such as mobile phones, key cards, and GPS devices, with a focus on security and privacy concerns that are often overlooked. Robert's been an active journalist since 1999, writing for PC World, Forbes, ThreatPost, and CNET. Robert has a BA in communications from Northwestern, where he double majored in film and English literature. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's quite an honor.
Thanks. Let's just jump right in. So I was on the board of a company called Signature America that was based in Atlanta. And every time I went to Atlanta for a board meeting, I rented a car, maybe about 11 times or so, and I used the Neverlost system. And as a result of using the Neverlost system, I have absolutely no clue how Atlanta is laid out or what the major interstate pattern is or any of that stuff. So the question is, are we all doomed to idiocy or gadget dependence in the modern world?
Some of us are. I opened the book with an example of a 21-year-old student in England who borrowed her boyfriend's TomTom unit to visit his parents for the first time in, I believe, Wales. And it was late at night, it was pouring rain, and she followed that literally to the point that she stopped the car on some railroad tracks. She didn't know it at the time. She just saw a gate and went to open the gate. And as she did so, the 9 o'clock special came barreling down the tracks and destroyed her car behind her. Fortunately, she was not injured.
Holy
but
cow.
It just shows how, with all these great gadgets that we have in our lives, that we're sort of zoning out the real world. We're kind of forgetting that we have the ultimate power, that the gadgets really don't control us. We control them.
Yeah, so stopping on train tracks equals bad.
Well, it wasn't listed. That was her defense, was it didn't list the railroad tracks on her TomTom unit. So, you know, the map was inferior to looking out of the window and seeing for herself where she really was.
Right. Yeah, so I guess people come to rely on these things being infallible, which is an interesting thing. Most people seem to think of technology, I guess, as magic that sort of just works. But us geeks know that to make something simple enough to be compelling to normals, it has to be unbelievably complicated inside. So a case in point would be maybe the iPad, which is really simple to use, but if you had to build one, well, good luck. So do you think we've lost track of complexity as a society that sort of gives rise to these magic items? And will we all become sort of cargo cult shamans?
Well, I think we're at a point in history where we may have gone a little too far on the convenience side. We've had, you know, a few years of having wizards that get us up and running within seconds, and we don't have a lot of say as to what's default on and default off.
Mm-hmm.
We just accept because we want to make that connection as soon as possible. We want to use that gadget as soon as it comes out of the box. And I think we may start going back in the other direction where people will say, well, wait a minute, do I really need Bluetooth? I'm going to turn that off. And do I really need that? I'm going to turn that off.
Right,
but
right.
We haven't quite gone there yet, and I don't know what the triggering point is going to be. Hopefully books like mine will start the discussion.
There's some vendors who, you know, work on secure by default, and that's good. So, you know, with the default settings, if you use the wizard, you're not going to really screw up your security posture. But there are probably more that don't. I'm thinking, when I think about complexity, though, more about the inner workings of these gadgets and the ways that they're constructed. And often, you know, that construction, the very complexity, it's hidden from the end user. The end user doesn't know how it works, and maybe the end user shouldn't know how it works. Do you think that end users should be more aware of the complexity of their gadgets, or should that be something that the geeks take care of?
I think that's something for the geeks to take care of.
Oh, thanks. I knew you were going to say that.
I don't think the average person needs to burden themselves with whether there's an operating system in their car or whether it's a series of buses that communicate individual discrete electrical systems to one another. I don't think the end user really cares. They just know that when they hit the brake, they want the anti-lock brake system to engage correctly. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily want to think about, oh, all the different interconnections that are going on at this second.
Right. Right. So that's a challenge for us geeks, because normals don't really care as long as the brakes work. And geeks need to make sure that it's safe enough for the normals to use. And sometimes there's a disconnect. It strikes me that maybe your book is playing at the boundaries of that disconnect between high geekdom and normal people.
It is a little bit, and I think in the book I talk about Mercedes, who had up to 700 different electrical systems at one point in their high-end cars, and they realized that they were going down in the J.D. Powers ranking because people were complaining that their cars were constantly being serviced because mm-hmm. of some problem, and they realized that complexity was not always the answer, and so they pulled about 400 of those features out of the next model of their car mm-hmm. in order to, you know, strike a balance with what consumers really needed and not these extra features. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I know somebody who bought one of those, and I got in it for a ride to lunch one day. And, you know, I shut the door, and then the window went zhoot up just a little bit. And I told the guy, you know, I'll be surprised if that lasts longer than a year, the little servo motor that makes the window move up every time you close the door. And sure enough, that was the first thing that failed in that car. So too many things. You're right about that. Let's talk about security a little. So Avi Rubin's spectacular RFID hacks of a few years ago were really nothing more than an attacker in the middle attack leveraging some broken crypto because the Texas Instruments guys has screwed up the crypto. So the magic falls apart quickly in the face of an attacker, this sort of tech magic we've been alluding to. So why do designers forget to think through security and privacy issues when they build our gadgets?
That's a very interesting question. We have a lot of companies out there that are producing technology goods and gadgets for us to consume that don't have security departments. They don't have security people built into the process. The Sony PlayStation, for example, last year got hacked, and it did have security, but it didn't have very robust security, nor did Sony have a chief information security officer on board.
They have one now.
They do now, and it's amazing that a lot of these big companies...
He's a listener, by the way, so say hello to him.
I will. Hi, Sony. Have to learn these things, and you know they're moving into spaces that where they really do need the security, but there isn't a lot of expertise yet in that area, and mm-hmm. so we need to start educating people about embedded systems and security in those systems.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I also think that by and large, people who build things, especially developers, and you probably know that my background is in software security, mm-hmm. Are often not taught to think about the attacker's perspective when they're building something. It's hard enough in some sense to make sure that your bridge stands up to normal physics, and much harder if you have to deal with earthquake conditions. Of course, you know, mechanical engineers do that sort of thing all the time, but we have to do the equivalent when it comes to engineering our gadgets.
Yeah, like 20 years ago with software, software was being put out there, and nobody thought who was going to attack it. And all of a sudden, buffer overflows and all these common things began to show up. And mm-hmm. so we nailed down, I think, software today is much better than it was 20 years ago.
Getting better, now, but we're not done, just for the record.
we're not done, correct. But now gadgets are under fire. Uh-huh. And the presumption has always been, who's going to attack this thing? Who's going to do a brute force attack against, as you mentioned, you know, the crypto in your car key fob? Or
well, Rubin, of course.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was done in 2004.
Right.
So we got to turn that around and begin thinking defensively with anything that we design. We got to think, how could somebody think outside the box and attack this gadget that I'm creating? Yeah. Don't just think about the bling bling and how great it's going to be once you get it up and running. No, think about who's going to take this thing apart with something relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the hacks that I talk about in my book are not really sophisticated things. I hear this all the time where people say it takes a small nation state in order to do an attack against this device. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, those are crazy government types saying that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, those of us who've been doing this for a while know how complicated these systems are and how easy some of the failures are. I mean, let's talk about Stuxnet for a minute, right? So that's mm-hmm. a good one for embedded devices. First of all the attention was paid to the wrong part, the delivery. So there was 1 0 day and three things that hadn't been patched yet. But, you know, that wasn't really the interesting bit. The interesting bit was the PLC attack. The PLC attack used something called DLL interpositioning, which frankly doesn't even work today against online game systems, but it works great against Siemens controllers.
Right.
Go figure. and so that's like nation state, I suppose. It's nation state complexity if you count World of Warcraft as a nation state.
Well, there you have an example of the PLCs are out there in the field. They're all over the ICS world, and nobody thinks about them because they haven't been attacked. Well, then Stuxnet comes along, and suddenly they're attacked. Mm-hmm. And it was a very specific instance, but now we're seeing a lot of researchers coming forward with SCADA attacks. Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting is a lot of the researchers publishing these vulnerabilities have no background in SCADA.
Right, right.
Well, they're finding the low-hanging fruit.
Instead of saying
there.
SCADA, I like to say, controllers.
Fine. Because industrial controllers that are out there,
yep.
they're finding the low-hanging fruit against these systems. They're not even probing very deeply. They don't even need to know the PLC languages.
Yep.
They're just going at them and saying, well, what can I knock out first?
Exactly.
Oh, look, I knocked them out.
Yeah, let's take the most obvious thing. Oh, gee, that works. But
right.
This reminds me of stuff we were doing in 96. We were working on breaking Java when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the best technique of all was sit around and drink beer and talk about how they probably would have done that. And then turns out they did do that, and that was wrong. So then you just break it because, obvious mistakes.
Yeah. From the attacker's perspective, it's a lot like horseshoes. Close counts, you know?
Right.
You just have to do a denial of service attack, and you win.
Right. So people seem to relish in exploits and hacks and crashes and burning cars and stuff like that. Plus, it sells bits if you're in the reporting field like you are. So how can we avoid the NASCAR effect? I call it the NASCAR effect attractor in journalism and focus on the hard work of building security in?
Oh, that's a very good question. I guess we could always put a caveat at the end of every story saying, but if you had used a secure software development lifecycle, you would not have this problem. I don't know. There's always going to be new reporters coming onto the scene. Mm-hmm. The learning curve in security is large.
Yeah, it's deep.
I know in 99 when I started, I would walk away from Black Hat or DEF CON with a headache because there would just be all these new terms that I would have to go and learn.
I think it was those parties the night before, but whatever.
It could be that too. I must say, one thing that you didn't find out about me is I'm a newly minted CISSP.
Oh, no, I knew that. I just didn't
mention right.
it. I don't really
all
care.
Right. Fine. But there is a way that you can keep journalists straight, and that is to educate
there
them.
You go.
Make sure that, yep. That we understand what we're talking about when we write it and not just write the latest thing that some vendor tells us about this product.
Sure. And most reporters do a good job with that. I guess the problem that I'm thinking of is more like, why is it easy to write about the bug of the day and people really care to read that because it's cool and sexy, and it's harder to write about something like the BSIM, which thank you, you've done. But it isn't sexy, and people are like, BSIM, that's for specialists. So there's got to be some way to figure out this middle ground. I don't know.
Yeah. It turn on the TV news, open a newspaper. It's, man bites dog and not dog bites man.
Right.
You look for something that's unusual, and unfortunately it's the car crash, it's just, the shootout at the bank, et cetera, that makes the news.
Right.
And it's not always the positive things that get reported, and that's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. So it's just human nature. Alas,
yeah.
We're stuck with the NASCAR effect. And here we all wanted the Volvo Car Safety Channel.
Right. But the thing is, after a certain point, people do rise up and say, I don't want this to happen to my medical device. I don't want this to happen to my car.
Right.
I want to do something about it.
Right.
And so they push back. Either they stop buying those products that are defective,
mm-hmm.
and then the vendors start making changes about it. And then you start seeing the stories about how, Ford turned themselves around after going nearly bankrupt and
right,
all.
Right.
So.
so the invisible hand works.
Over time.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So I have to take you to task about a word. I worry about your use of the word betray in the book title, because I'm not surprisingly more of a Hofstadter Dennett intentional stance sort of guy when it comes to machines. So I was thinking about your science fiction work and how you think about machines. And don't you think that the word betray sort of implies intelligence and maybe maliciousness on the part of our gadgets?
Well, it was softer than some of the other words that my publisher came up with.
Do tell. This is good. Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah. I can't remember the early titles for this book. I wanted to call it The Dark Side of Convenience.
Ooh, I like that. That's beautiful.
Well, it did, but it didn't resonate. And, you know, they were like, what art would we put on that? I'm like, art?
So they build a focus group for you?
No, I believe they pushed back and said they wanted revenge of everyday things.
Oh, okay.
And working off of revenge, I said, no, that's too hard. That implies, as you just said, a maliciousness. So I proposed to them when gadgets betray us, and they were like, oh, we love it.
Yeah. It's not bad. It just sort of implies this artificial intelligence that we haven't quite attained yet, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'll tell you how I intended it, and that is we put a lot of trust in these gadgets, and we walk away from them.
Yes.
And so later, when they leak our personal information or something we didn't intend, they're betraying us in that regard. They're not intelligent in any way, but they are, you know, failing in some way that we intended them.
So it's in a sense of you had faith in it, and so the betrayal is just that loss of faith or something like that.
Yeah, and that's a theme throughout the book.
Mm-hmm. So it's funny because, you know, we build these risks right into these things. And the challenge that we have as builders, you know, most people listening to this podcast, is figuring out what that balance should be. What is the right thing to you know, what's the right balance to strike between protecting people from themselves and just letting people go ahead and park their car on the train tracks if they want.
Right. Well, like the payment systems that are out there right now, there's a move towards contactless. And what I hear from the card brands is that they say it shaves 3 seconds off of the average transaction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, really? Okay, so now my card can be read from 20 feet away by someone standing in line, and that's not a problem for you, but that extra 3 seconds of security is.
Yeah, this can go both ways. I remember the University of Michigan had a smart card payment system that Schlumberger had designed and put into the campus, so you could use your smart card enabled student ID to buy Cokes out of the Coke machine. But the problem was, when they did the pilot, if you actually authenticated the card to the machine, it took 30 seconds. And next time you buy a Coke, stick in the coins and then wait 30 seconds before you press the button. And you'll see how infinitely long that is.
Yeah.
So it definitely goes in both directions. And then, you know, there's all the time that we've all wasted waiting for Microsoft's operating systems to boot. I think somebody did some hilarious calculations about the amount of gross domestic product that gets wasted while everyone's waiting around.
You know, yeah.
Old stuff from the old days. Many design decisions that we're faced with come with really thorny philosophical problems attached. Medical records provide big data for trend mining, but they also include reams of very private data that people don't want to get exposed. So does the public good outweigh personal privacy when it comes to medicine? What do you think?
Well, with medicine, there are ways to anonymize the data and still get the benefits from it. So I don't think that you have to have it specific to someone's area code and address to extract the fact that people living in a certain state are more likely to have this type of cancer than other states. So we can still get the public good. We just need to do a better job of maybe, I hate to say it, regulating what is stored and what is shared.
Right. So, but those are challenging things. I mean, if you think about somebody who all day long just makes machines work and just does database stuff and, you know, big data mining, right. Now they're faced with this philosophy question. They may not be prepared to make those sorts of decisions.
Well, that's where you get external agencies like the FDA or National Institute of Health, somebody else making those calls as to what's relevant and what's not for the purposes of anonymizing data. Now, the thing that you alluded to there is very interesting because storage is getting cheaper and cheaper. And so a lot of these big data companies are collecting everything, not because they ever intend to use it, because they don't know 10 years from now if it's going to be valuable. So why not collect it? And we need to, I think, wise up a little bit about the privacy aspects of that 10 years down the road. We should certainly look to Europe and get some examples from them on what's working and what's not.
Yeah, the Europeans have a very interesting set of privacy laws. And, I mean, it's just a completely different perspective. If the data are about you, you own them. And in the States, we just don't have that concept at all. The data are generated by the grocery store about you, but the grocery store owns them. That's a different deal entirely.
Yeah.
And, you know, people are often willing to make these trade-offs in the States for convenience. So the frequent shopper card is a prime example of that. You know, so you save $3 and you let the grocery store know everything that you ever buy. And some people are willing to do that. Some people don't know they're making that trade-off. I guess most people probably do, and they make it anyway.
Right. And then there are people like me that try to obfuscate the information.
You were difficult to dig stuff up on, man. I'm telling you.
Well, I take that as a compliment. Thank you very much.
My people are good, too. My people are good. They didn't have much lead time this time, but still, they had trouble. So when my son, Jack, turned 14, I started him reading science fiction and got him to read stuff like the Foundation Trilogy, the Dune series, the Martian Chronicles, all the old stuff from when I was a kid. And my geeky friends, when I was telling them about that, said, well, why don't you have him read something new? And they turned me on to Charles Stross's amazing book, Accelerando. I love that book.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that you do too. So what does science fiction as a genre have to teach us about this topic we've been discussing?
Well, like I said, we got to look 10 years down the road. Science fiction looks 50 to 100 years down the road and plays out the trends that we're seeing today in a way that we can understand. So we can say, wow, I don't like this. I want to do something about it now. Or it inspires us. You know, the whole thing with the Google glasses and things like that come from the world of science fiction. And now people are building these things and making them real.
So how do you suppose Strauss ends up with 7 mind-boggling ideas in every one of his books? What's up with that guy?
I follow him on Twitter and I read his blog. I think the man never sleeps personally.
So maybe he's just a little manic.
I think so. He just absorbs everything around him and he turns it into, you know, sentient lobsters and things like that. It's absolutely amazing stuff and I really like it. If you want something a little more traditional but yet very new, I would recommend Dan Simmons' Hyperion series.
Oh, cool. Okay. That's great.
Or the Endymion sequel that followed. Both are really classic science fiction, but they were written in the 80s and 90s.
Cool, cool. So another question sort of from left field. My brother also has a degree from Northwestern, but his degree is in the very lucrative field of poetry, which is even less useful than English lit and film. So tell us about your story. What was it called, With or Without You? Which is about filming a movie, and was that story written before you shot The Contender or not?
That story was written before I wrote did The Contender, which is a 16mm motion picture.
Right.
So I wrote the short story in high school, actually.
Oh, wow.
And it was about a a film that gets interrupted because the lead actress has died, and so the producer is intent on finishing it and begins digital production of the actress, which today we don't think much about, but at the time that I wrote it, it was, you know, still new enough, and I talk about the ethical issues of whether or not this performance was better than her real-life performance.
Was that around the time of Jessica Rabbit?
No, I don't remember what necessarily triggered it, but it sold and got published in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah, that's really cool. I tried to find a copy on the net for free, and I couldn't dig one up. Alas, the BitTorrent doesn't have it yet. Maybe we'll fix that. So, and then finally, as a last question, which has nothing to do with anything, what's your favorite music written and produced after 2010?
After 2010?
Mm-hmm.
How to Destroy Angels.
Wow. And is that a band? I don't even know.
Yeah, it's Trent Reznor's new band after he collapsed Nine Inch Nails.
Wow, cool. Great. Thanks very much. This has been really fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. Thank you, Gary.
It was super quick. So this has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April 2012 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on security training and education. The Silver Bullet interview features our chat with Dacient founder Neil Daswani, whose company was recently acquired by Twitter. Congratulations, Neil. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.